Meeting. All right. I will now call this meeting to order. The time is 5:04 p.m. This meeting that is open to the public and will be recorded. Please make sure your Zoom name matches your first and last name. We ask for all commissioners to have their cameras on if they are able to do so during the meeting. If you need to step away, please let us know so we can maintain quorum. If you get disconnected, please rejoin or call in to the Zoom meeting. Staff and presenters may turn their cameras on when they are speaking. Members of the public should keep their cameras off for the whole meeting. Okay. All righty then. I'm going to get this roll call started. We'll start by taking roll. Please provide your name and role, and I'm going to go first. My name is Dr. Commissioner Wiley, and I am the chair. Proud to be here. Okay. All right. And let's see. Popcorn out, Commissioner Adler Curry.
Good evening, everyone. J.L. Curry, Commissioner and Alder, representing the Common Council.
Commissioner Kathleen.
Kathleen Callan, Commissioner.
Hey, Commissioner Lynn.
Commissioner Lynn, pleased to be here.
Commissioner Casey.
Commissioner Casey Edmonds Estes, happy to be here.
Commissioner Kirsten.
Kristen Witzling, Commissioner. Nice to see y'all.
Commissioner Madeley, Commissioner Melissa.
Melissa Madeley, Commissioner.
Commissioner, Dr. Commissioner Love.
Good evening, Dr. Larry Love, Commissioner.
Hey, Commissioner Frost, Joe, want to give it a go?
Sure. Joe Frost, Commissioner.
Hey, Commissioner Renee.
Wait, are you talking? I am not a commissioner. I'm
Thank
city
you.
staff. Sorry.
No, you're helping me get to really like know everybody better. Okay. So thank you for correcting me. Austin, Commissioner Austin. See, now I'm like,
Nope, just member of the public.
okay. Member of the public. I'm so glad you're here. Hello. I'm just gonna put a little sticky note there. Commissioner Maggie.
Hi, Maggie Groshian, Commissioner, and Rebecca's intern. Glad to be here again.
Okay. Did I miss anyone? If I do, please charge it to my head and not my heart. That is my culture coming out. Just letting you know. Did we handle that business? All right. Okie dokie. I would like to move on. Let's see. Wait. I would like to move on to the approval of minutes. So let's review the minutes from our June 27th, 2024 meeting. Okay.
I'll just do a quick scroll through.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any amendments to the meetings? Are there? Is there?
I move to approve the minutes.
Okay, is there a second?
Second.
This is
Right.
Melissa. I'm seconding.
All right. All in favor? Okay, are there any opposed? Okay, we will move on. Okay, right now, let's see. Do we have a pub? We have someone from the public. I'm excited, yay. So we welcome public comments and reserve a portion of the agenda for people who are registered to speak. Okay, each registrant will have 3 minutes to speak and 6 minutes if you are using an interpreter, okay? Right? And here you can ask, you know, we're ready for it. Any open, do we have someone from the public?
Yep, I'm from the public, but I don't have any comments. Just some of the subjects seemed interesting, so I wanted to learn more.
Oh, wonderful. Well, welcome. Well, okay. We're going to keep on going. Okay, any disclosures or recusals? All right. We're going to move on to new business. And please forgive me, I want to go back. I didn't state the line, item 8451 for public comment, but there are none. All right. New business. We're going to go to line item 84517. That will be the parking presentation. Are we ready? All right. Welcome.
Thank you. Have,
our attention. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Stephanie Cox. I am the parking division manager. I have with me tonight Bill Putnam, who is our engineer in the parking division, and we're just going to provide you with a presentation of our division, kind of give you an overview of the services that we have under us, and just trying to figure out, you know, as we move forward, how to collaborate with this group. Okay, let me start sharing. Can I get approval to share my screen?
Who does that on our end? Who? Yeah, does
there we go.
Can you make Stephanie a co-host, please? Perfect.
I have it. Thank you. Okay. One second here. Wouldn't be right without some type of technology issue, right? Okay, here we go. All right. So this was uploaded into Legistar. I did change the presentation a little bit from what was uploaded, but it's the same information. I just sorted it out a little better for everyone. So again, my name is Stephanie Cox, and I have with me tonight Bill Putnam. So just a little background on the parking division. We were formerly known as the parking utility. Our name was changed several years ago to a division. We are an enterprise agency, so we are fully self-funded. We do not pull from the general fund. We actually help contribute to the general fund. We are responsible for 7 public garages, 5 lots, and over 1,400 metered spaces. That's both on and off street. We employ a staff of roughly about 104 full-time employees and 20 hourly employees. In 2001, the parking enforcement unit was added into the division with the final transition happening at the end of last year. So that was something very excited and actually close to my heart because I came from the parking enforcement division. And then last year, we implemented our transportation demand management program. We also offer 6 different parking permit options to customers. Like I mentioned earlier, we are an enterprise agency. So our revenues that are generated come from payments from payments at meters, garages, and permits. So those remain with the division. And then like any citation payments would go to the general fund. And then we also work very closely. So we're under the transportation umbrella. So we work very closely with traffic engineering and Madison Metro. And please feel free, if anyone has questions, I'm not sure if you want to wait till the end or if you want to ask them as I go along, but I'll keep going until somebody stops me. So the parking division is broken out into four different sections. Our service areas are administration, operations, enforcement, and transportation demand management. The services we provide are permits, maintenance. So we handle all of the maintenance to our facilities. That includes anything from construction in the garages to installing of meters to our equipment that we use. We have cashiering. So we have the cashiers, the customer service ambassadors at the garages. Our parking enforcement officer. So we have a 24/7 parking enforcement operation, and there are 34 employed in that unit. And then our transportation demand management, which is our newer section, and that has one employee. So I kind of wanted to go into, I know this most recent change we had was to our event parking. So I wanted to just kind of explain the difference with our different pricing structures. So we have our standard pricing that is all the time in our garages. That is your hourly rate. When we have an event that happens nearby that's going to have impact on the garage, some garages will switch to a special event or an event rate. And this is something that has been around for as long as I can remember. And we just recently increased the rates in those garages that had last been increased in 2016. So just kind of to explain why we do it. So really the event rate is to help with the rush. So you know that you're going to have people exiting approximately all at the same time. And so in order to make it flow better, if you pay when you enter, which is the event rate, so you're not paying for the time you're there, you're paying one flat rate. We collect that at the entrance. So then when you exit, you're quicker getting out. If you have people trying to pay as they exit, if you've ever sat through a garage trying to exit after an event, it takes a while. So you would pretty much double that time trying to exit. So that's why we do an event rate. It's usually the high demand of the garage. It requires additional staff because we have to have staff there kind of monitoring, seeing when the garage fills, making sure people are getting in at a reasonable pace so it's not backing up traffic, and then for that faster exit time. One of the other areas that we cover are accessible parking. And Bill, I'm going to let you take it from here.
Okay. Thanks, Stephanie. Hi, my name is Bill Putnam. I use the pronouns he, him. I'm the engineer with the parking division. We do in all of our facilities, garages, and all non-permitted off-street facilities provide accessible parking spaces. However, due to the age of some of our facilities, most of them are more than 40 years old. They are not necessarily up to current ADA standards. We try to improve the accessibility at those facilities as we're able, but some challenges are difficult for us to surmount, like the height of the garage, for instance, may preclude a van accessible space, and it's not financially feasible to rebuild the garage with higher ceilings. Our two new facilities were built to current requirements, but we've found that while they may have met the letter of the code, the intent that wasn't necessarily followed through with. And we've had some former members of the Parking Council for People with Disabilities assist us with kind of going through these garages along with Rebecca and some of her staff to identify deficiencies in these new facilities as well as our existing ones. And we're working on some improvements to those, which we'll get to in a little bit. So I guess that's that slide, Stephanie. I don't know if you want to go to the next one. Right. So as we mentioned, permit holders, accessible parking for all permit holders are available in our non-permitted city lots and parking garages. We have one lot that's a permit-only lot that's not open to the public that currently does not have an accessible space marked. The rest of them all do. One thing that some folks with a permit may not be aware of and that we try to educate people about is that anyone with a hang tag or license plate allows them to park at a 30-minute or longer time-limited space without the requirement to pay or to abide by the time limit on that space. So, for instance, that our 1 or 2 hour meters that we have on the street, like the one in the photo here, someone with a valid hang tag or license plate could park at that without being required to pay basically all day. Other restrictions such as a peak hour tollway still need to be followed, but in general, that does provide a lot of access for folks. And then the gated sections of our facilities do require payment, though we do have accessible spaces in those facilities. Next slide. Some of the projects we're working on are currently newest garage, the Wilson Street Garage, has had a lot of elevator reliability issues. The elevator vestibule doors are really not accessible. And I had someone with a power chair try to access the elevator vestibule, and due to the size of the chair and the placement of structural columns in the garage and width of the doorways, it was physically not possible to access that lobby. So we're working on getting a project to widen those doors, put automatic openers on those doors to make it much more accessible. It's been a bit of a frustration because it was a brand new garage that was very expensive and we didn't get quite what we thought we were getting. Next one is Overture Center Garage. That's an older garage built in 1982 near the Overture Center. And there we'll be doing a lighting upgrade as well as door and window replacements. All of the accessible spaces in that garage are on ground level, so that at least makes it a little bit simpler to get access to that garage. And then at our State Street Capitol garage, which is on Carroll Street between Johnson and Dayton, we're doing an electrical upgrade with a new emergency backup generator, which helps power the elevators in that garage, which is important because we've got accessible stalls in the upper levels of the garage, right close to the elevator lobbies. And we want to keep those elevators operating at all times. Hi, Joel, see your hand up.
Yeah, if you don't mind, a couple of questions I've had commonly come up, like I'm a power wheelchair user, I have a caregiver drive me around in a van or use paratransit. But yeah, a couple of quick questions. One would be like possibly for future projects, like think, 10 year, 20 year sort of window, new garages, new changes. What are some possibilities for either like prepay or that would make it easier? Like, for example, I know of some drivers, myself included for a brief time, that would be able to drive a van from our power chair, but can't reach the current like cash or punch in apparatus, and I'm just wondering if, like there are some things out on the market or in, you know, the potential for future projects that could be entertained to accommodate that, even if it's like prepay online, then you drive in and it registers your license plate.
Yeah, I think that's definitely something we're working on. I don't know, Stephanie, if you want to jump in here, because you're at the forefront of that project.
Yeah, we are actually in the process of upgrading our park, our equipment in our garages. So we're hoping that we'll start next year, but we are going to be upgrading our software and the equipment, the entry pay stations and the garages. So it will be more customer friendly in a lot of cases where you can pay through through an app. So you're not needing to actually physically access the pay station and try to pay at it when you enter or exit. And it'll give more options for paying ahead of time, or it actually allows for more permit options, more options to work with a lot of the venues in the area where they can set up accounts. So we are definitely looking at trying to improve that, because that is, I have heard that a lot, that our current system is not very user-friendly. So that is in the works, and we're hoping that we'll start next year.
Ah, thank you for that note. Mind if I just ask a quick second question?
Sure.
Yeah, I was just wondering if, whether in the garages or other spaces, you know, like if there are a variety of stalls, like for rear loading vehicles, side loading vehicles, you know, like for example, I have a side loading minivan, you know, that requires a certain amount of space to get my power chair out from the adjacent stall. But I know of, you know, some, including some of the Union Cab fleet, that are rear loading, you know, and a great example is at the Easttown Mall, you know, they've designed spaces to accommodate either, you know, same for some of the Walmarts. And I'm just curious if there are plans to possibly add spaces like that in some of the existing ramps.
I'm going to let Bill answer that one.
I guess one observation is that anyone with a valid hang tag or plate can back into a stall, whereas we require most of our customers to pull in with the front of the car pull in straight and not back in. So that gives a little more options with a side loading van, depending upon which side the access aisle is on that stall. You know, it's definitely something that for us to think about. There's a couple different options for access aisle widths, and also the widths for the accessible stalls. You know, and one of the options is an 8 foot wide access aisle versus a 5 foot wide. And most 5 foot wide access aisles are not going to accommodate a side loading power chair. You know, I'd be curious if you're familiar if you think an 8 foot wide would be sufficient, or if that's still not enough.
Yeah, I think generally speaking, for the side loaders, like for example, that ANJ Mobility puts out, even that Union Cab is partnering with ANJ Mobility on, that's accommodated my wheelchair. And actually, my brother drives a similar van, same condition, power wheelchair, and that's accommodated him too, you know. So, yeah, I think generally the 8 footers, you know, do well. It's just, yeah, sometimes I think some of the 5 foots give a little struggle or can be a little tight, you know, depending on the setup.
Yeah, that's great feedback. And, you know, that helps us kind of try to work to find more of the eight opportunities for the 8 foot wide access aisle rather than the minimum of five. So, you know, I appreciate that comment, and we'll definitely kind of keep that in mind as we look at restriping some of our spaces in the garages.
Yeah, because I know some around some of the communities I'm in discussing disability, even just labeling intent of stalls, you know, like to have a couple 5 foots, a couple 8 foots, but communicate, you know, that the 5 foots, you know, may be designed, you know, for say those getting out, you know, like that don't need that full ramp display space. Well, the 8 foots, you know, may be more intended for side loading vehicles, just to help communicate with everybody. I mean, I know at the end of the day it depends on who is parking in there, but sometimes just, even the conversation and communication on the signage, can go a long way. Well, thank you for that.
Absolutely. Let's see, Melissa.
Thank you very much. So I kind of want to piggyback on what Joe said. I think 8 foot is like a minimum if you have a side loading vehicle. An 8, 5 foot is like a ramp comes out at the edge, but then you don't have enough room to get your wheelchair off or on loaded that way. And I'm wondering, Stephanie mentioned the upgrades and stuff are going on. Do you guys have people with lived experience that you're working with? I think you mentioned something about a parking council. And if you don't have anyone with lived experience, I will volunteer to be helpful if you guys would like my input.
Yeah, in the past we did the city had a parking council for people with disabilities that advised both our department and the Common Council on matters related to access and transportation, and that committee disbanded in 2018 due in part to us having a real challenge getting enough volunteers. It was a committee of nine, 7 people with 2 alternates, and boy, we really tried, and the community members really tried to get people to serve, and we just for several years failed to meet quorum, meeting after meeting after meeting. So that, along with the larger citywide reorganization of committees, resulted in the duties of that committee being folded into the Transportation Commission. For me, I'm just going on the experience and the connections I've had from that committee. And unfortunately, several of the people on that committee have passed away, so my resources are dwindling for people to who to talk to, and definitely would appreciate
I'll recruit.
that would
I'll recruit
if
lots of
you,
people.
yeah we yeah we need the those lived experiences, and it's frequently an eye-opener for me to go around with folks and have them explain why this is not working, or if this is better. Kind of those in the real practical application, what works and what doesn't. So really would appreciate your help, and when we come up with questions, because we do, the city is constantly changing, and I've felt a loss after that committee was disbanded, and thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I had seen that a while ago because it was like I thought this was a novel idea of mine, and then it's like nope, that was tried, and I don't know what happened, but that's awesome that it was tried. And anyways, commence with your presentation. I just wanted to share that, and I'll be in with Rebecca or somebody to pass my information along to you guys. So,
Wonderful, thank you.
thank you.
So next on just for upcoming projects that we're working on is curb management. And this is one that I know I'm very excited about. It's something we desperately need. So we are looking at how we currently are using curb space and kind of starting over and understanding what are our actual needs now. Before the pandemic, it looked very different. After the pandemic, we have a lot of open space and we realize that we can use it differently. So we are in the very, very early stages of this, and this is a combined effort across multiple different agencies. Transportation will be leading it. But we're looking at how can we provide better access to the curb for loading and unloading efforts, waste collection, maintenance, accessible parking, bike lanes, bike share, streeteries, maybe a parklet. Just trying to, as the city continues to grow and these redevelopments are happening, we've noticed that that curb space is being changed, and we're not providing the access that we believe that we need in those areas. So this is going to be probably a, I'd say probably a 2-year project. It's a pretty long project. But this is something that we definitely will want to hear from this commission about. And we will, you know, hopefully be coming back multiple times and asking you guys, you know, what do you need? Where are you seeing areas that need improvement? What do you think needs to be out there that isn't currently there? Or what is there that you want to keep? So this is a really exciting project for me, coming from the enforcement world and having to, you know, deal with the enforcement of it. It's a struggle. So this is something that will be coming that we're pretty excited about. Joe?
Oh, yeah. And if I can just share a thought, even on that note, like I work for the county, you know, and work at the city county building. And for years, I've seen it, you know, with like paratransit, for illustration, you know, like loading and unloading on the Wilson Street side, that like having designated zones for either cargo loading or for paratransit, medical, or, you know, like quick access, you know, like where somebody's dropping off somebody to gain access to the building, you know, can go a long way. Because especially on the Wilson Street side, anybody that's been around the city county building sees how there's a major bottleneck there and some major challenges. And I mean, that just illustrates, you know, some thoughts of citywide, even starting with just city properties, of thoughts that, you know, would be great to have, you know, like zones to help, you know, facilitate those bottlenecks.
Yes, definitely. And I feel you on the construction and everything going around the city county building. It is tough over there right now.
For a laugh, if I can share, you know, that I just often tell paratransit drivers, I know they said to drop me off on Wilson, just let's go Martin Luther King. I'll just walk.
Yeah. I'll be excited when the street is back open. We will be reaching out to this group, several other commissions as well, just to, as we work on this plan and understanding, like, what do we want the city to look like, to make sure that we, you know, hear from everybody that is in the city and uses these streets. So, and then my last slide is just kind of talk about the past level of engagement that we were doing, and the changes that we plan on making. So we do have, we do engage with a lot of the downtown organizations, businesses, because we are, you know, we have most of our structures are downtown, the meters are downtown. So we do work very closely with a lot of the downtown organizations, but we do know that that needs to improve, and we do need to expand who we're working with. So we are looking to improve on our engagement and outreach, and not just on parking though. We want to expand on transportation as a whole. So we're going to develop a larger engagement outreach plan that will be to discuss transportation initiatives, parking, traffic engineering, and metro. And to maybe try not to focus just one area, but do everything under that umbrella. So that is my presentation. I don't know if anyone has any additional questions. We're happy to answer. Joe?
Yeah, not to ask all the questions tonight, but yeah, another thought that even came up from a great group that Melissa and I were in, the Home Healthcare Initiative group, you know, that caregivers generally have, you know, troubles, especially in the downtown where, you know, they have to drive client to client, they have to park, and often are struggle to find a space or get ticketed when they do. And as part of that group, we had discussed if there would be the opportunity for permitting options or leniencies, you know, where they could either get discounted permits or get leniencies that if they get a ticket but can demonstrate that they're working with the client or with a care agency, you know, that they might get exemptions or, you know, be able to more easily waive that, you know, because I've had a number of mine when I lived over by the Caribou just off of East Johnson, you know, got ticketed different times of the year, you know, just doing my cares to get me like up into my wheelchair and that. And I think that would be a great thing to look into going forward, just to help the city's disabled community with caregivers. Thanks.
Sure, thank you. Just to touch on that, we have kind of been working on that over the years, not so much in the metered zones, but in like the residential permit only areas or the residential permit zones, where we did create a caregiver permit so that they could park in those zones in excess of the 2 hour. But we have not really dove into the paid parking areas. As we work on the curb management plan, we are looking at identifying ways that like delivery drivers or somebody that's doing business downtown can either have an account set up or pay for their time in a different way in those spaces. So that's something that we just haven't really dove into yet, but we do realize that that is an issue. So thank you. We will make sure that that gets included. Okay.
Oh, and thank you for enlightening me.
Okay. Kathleen?
Yes, thank you. When you mentioned the upgrade to the parking payment systems, I was made me wonder, is this going to possibly allow for, I'm sort of thinking of like different price levels for different events at the same time in the parking. Like the example I think of is a parking ramp that, and I believe this is a public ramp, forgive me if I'm not, but one that's close to say the Sylvie, but then that's also connected to the art, you know, and those, you know, just being there, you know, trying to coordinate those two very different, you know, missions and purposes, but using the same parking. Is that something that possibly will be able to be adjusted or allowed for with the new system?
That was something that came up during the event rate increase. And we've been working with our vendor to understand what flexibility there is. And I've talked with a lot of cities across the country to also see how they're handling it. The difference is, generally, there aren't two rates you can do at the same time. And we, because we operate as an enterprise agency, other cities, like maybe the arts district actually controls that garage and they run it, but we don't operate that way. So it does make it a little tricky, but we are looking to see like with the events and the event venues really are excited about this, like being able to have people pre-purchase their parking ahead of time at a different rate. So then maybe we wouldn't have to turn on the event rate if you can pre-purchase it in advance. So we're looking at different options. We haven't explored them all yet, but it is something that's on our list of like, what can we do? Are there changes we can make?
Great, thank you. I think for equity, yeah. You know, I can think of work situations too. You know, if you happen to be in a career that you have to do no matter what, regardless of a football game or things like that. So thank you for keeping that on your radar.
Absolutely.
All righty then. I want to say thank you. We appreciate you all your time and the wealth of knowledge that you brought to us. And we are going to move on. Line item 84516, Vision Zero update.
All right. So I'm Renee Calloway. I'm the Assistant Director in Traffic Engineering. And I co-lead our Vision Zero program, which is focused on traffic safety. I do have Jerry Shippa, one of our traffic signal engineers, with me here tonight. I know that there were a lot of questions that you emailed in, which was great because then Jerry could take a look at them in advance, that were really focused on kind of how we do traffic signals, pedestrian signals kind of stuff. So I'm going to launch in, and I'm also happy to be more informal and just take questions as we go along, but I will need someone to make me a co-host so that I can share my screen. the tricky Zoom.
You have the power.
All right. I feel very powerful now.
They'll take care of me.
All right. Let me just get this going correctly. Let's get your phone. Okay, here we roll. So Vision Zero Madison is, as I said, people are often like, what exactly does that mean? It's about traffic safety. It's for everyone, no matter how they're traveling. And, you know, this idea that no one should have a life-changing event just because they were trying to go somewhere, get around in our city. So quick overview. This is really focused on the worst type of traffic crashes, the fatalities, the ones with the very severe injuries, while also just making our city safer, healthier, more equitable, because we know that there is a large percentage of people living in our city who are non-drivers for a multiple reasons, and they should be able to safely move around our city. You should not have to be in a motor vehicle. This whole idea of Vision Zero started in Europe. Maybe you've heard about it. It's kind of come here to the US because there has been a lot of success in Europe with reducing these types of traffic crashes. We get a lot of questions about, well, how do you do that? And it's really more of a public health approach. It's about not like why was there a crash or just any kind of crash. It's why was someone seriously injured in the crash and what kinds of things could be done to either, you know, eliminate that crash or even just eliminate the severity of the crash. So instead of thinking about kind of everything is equal from a fender bender to a fatality, it's thinking more about reducing the injury side. But yes, maybe you are still going to see fender benders. Maybe you'll even see more fender benders, things that are minor crashes that everyone can walk away from without like a huge outcome, like that hospital visit. But it's, you're not going to have these things that are traumatic for everyone involved in the community. So we have a pretty big commitment here in our city to kind of having leadership and collaborating. It's a lot of departments working on it. It's our policymakers. It's our stakeholders, our community members who are like, yes, we want to reduce and eliminate those types of crashes. And we want to be a city that's known as being a leader for being safe to travel, no matter how you're doing it. We do a lot with data. And we try to really look at where there are disproportionate impacts, no matter, is it race, gender, ability, age, you know, what are those disproportionate impacts that we might be seeing? We do try to prioritize trying to do meaningful and equitable community engagement. Probably people hear the most around our speed management and trying to bring speeds down because speed is a huge factor in outcomes. And we do try to do regular reporting and have accountability, knowing that this is, it's a long game. This is something that's going to take a while to reach, but we want to see if we're kind of moving along in the right direction. We have something that you may have heard about. It's called our high injury network. These are streets that through some statistical analysis of crashes that are the most likely places for severe and fatal crashes to occur. And so we try to use that data to help as we have funding available and we're making changes. We do have some updates to this coming soon. You know, this data in our original one was based on crashes in 2017 through 2019. We were working on this just kind of in that maybe post-pandemic. I don't really know when that started, but kind of after the pandemic. And obviously we saw a lot of anomalies in our data. So we wanted to use the stuff before. And now this year we're going to be working on just teasing out more of the pedestrian and the bicycle focus, because motor vehicles are far overrepresented in this data. We do have serious and fatal ped bike crashes, injury crashes, but the number of them is small in comparison. So we want to do something focused just on those crashes and where those the most likely to be occurring. And then starting maybe even at the end of this year, beginning of next year, we'll be updating our overall high injury network that looks at all modes of travel crashes and using more recent data to update this map. So people ask a lot of questions about streets that are on there. There's usually
a pretty good statistical reason for that when you dig into it. But we do want to get that updated because the world has changed and, you know, crash patterns change and we improve streets. And so we want to keep this as up to date as we can. Just this is a slide about why speed really does matter and why we are changing speed limits. And it's just, it's kind of the facts of physics. If someone is driving at 40, their field of vision isn't very good. They have a much longer stopping distance. 305 feet is, you know, more of a moderate sized car. We know there are a lot of people driving much larger, heavier vehicles that take even longer to stop. And unfortunately, at 40, if someone is a pedestrian and they are hit by someone driving, it's a 73% likelihood of a fatal or severe injury. So speeds that are slower, it starts to go down. And at 20, you have a much better field of vision. So you can see what's happening on the street around you better. You can stop 115 feet for a moderate sized vehicle, a much shorter stopping distance, and only 13% of pedestrians are likely to have a fatal or severe injury. So it's not perfect, right? It could still happen, but it's so far reduced. So we do really want to focus on getting people driving safe speeds, setting speed limits that are appropriate for the context of the location. What might be appropriate on, you know, a highway like the Beltline is not the same even on East Washington, Park Street, Mineral Point Road, where there is just a lot more people and activity and things happening. We have an action plan that has been approved and it lays out strategies and actions kind of over the course of the next. It's kind of focused on the sort of that next 5 to 7 years. And will need to be updated, but it kind of lays out what are those things that we see that could make the biggest impact. This is both changing roadway changes. It is education, culture. It's how can we be more equitable in our approach? What kind of safety can we implement in the city-owned vehicles that we can model for other people who have fleets of vehicles? What kind of data do we need to keep us on the right track? And also, what kind of enforcement really can make an impact on fatal and serious crashes? And tries to look at avoiding disparate outcomes. Now, I know that you wanted to hear a little bit more about engagement, and we kind of we're doing our original engagement for Vision Zero and also a program I'll talk a little bit about in a moment called Complete and Green Streets. That's more about how we design our streets. We branded it Let's Talk Streets because after we went out and we talked to some people in the community who are not real transportation nerds, they were like, you really just have to be very kind of basic about what is it that you want to hear about. And they came up with a few ideas, but Let's Talk Streets really stuck as like people will get what you want to talk about if you're just very plain and upfront. So we've been starting to use that. We'll be using that a little bit more in some projects we have coming up. But through that work, we did a variety of surveys that went out to everyone in the community. We did some real focused engagement with our more diverse communities. And then we did a particularly a survey focused on people who self-reported as having a disability. Through that, one of the things that we did was create what we call a modal hierarchy or kind of, you know, different transportation modes. And when we were making decisions about designs, who should we be prioritizing? And that, as you'll see, it's people who are kind of walking using a mobility device are at the top. And that was very clearly reflected in what we heard across our groups. Then we have people taking transit, and that is something that really came out through our focus groups in our BIPOC communities, that they really felt like quality transit was critical and they wanted to see that second on the list, followed by biking, followed by people who are driving motor vehicles, and then even though parking isn't really a mode of transportation, it's there. And, you know, when tough choices need to be made about public space, the feeling generally was that parking is towards the bottom when those hard decisions are made. And obviously we have a variety of street types. Different street types put a higher priority, you know, on that, trying to keep that than others. But that was sort of where people felt like public space should go. We also talked about street values, and we did a variety of sort of trying to take in some ideas and then trying to put it into words and then see if this reflected what people felt they were saying. And the idea that people are the most important in the public space. It's more important to be safe than to be able to go as fast as you want to or get places really quickly. That community was more important than sort of this idea of it's more important for people to be able to pass through my neighborhood to get somewhere else. That this place should be just as important as any other place. The idea of sustainability, both trees, green infrastructure, being able to use a variety of choices other than just driving alone, and then trying to have equity in processes and outcomes, which have not historically always been the case. So we have some summary documents. I have a link that is in Legistar too, so that if you want to learn more about what we heard, we kind of have a whole summary document. I did want to highlight a few things, just this that we heard when we did our survey of people who self-reported having a disability. Some of the things that kind of lifted up from that survey was very challenges with crossing the street, particularly when there isn't a signal at a location. Streets that do not have sidewalks, just people driving inattentively or aggressively definitely came up as a huge concern. And then we did ask about just shared use path, because we do hear about conflicts between all kinds of users. And that came up as more of in the somewhat challenging for some people. So those are definitely things we've been keeping in mind with our projects as we move forward. Joe.
A very quick question of that original bar chart. Does that first question also include areas that have signals, but where the signals are not easily accessible? Like, for example, myself as a power wheelchair user with very limited arm reach, you know, like most of the signals around downtown are recessed, you know, off, you know, like the sidewalk, off in the grass, you know, like, and far from the curb cut. So especially in the winter, but even most year round, you know, they're not accessible to me to operate. So I have to operate just based on traffic flow or the courtesy of somebody else hitting the button.
Yeah. So I think, you know, probably the question about crossing the street when there is a signal was possibly a little bit too broad to really lift that up specifically. But I think, you know, that is definitely something that we've heard and something that we can talk about a little bit more when we get more into the signal stuff as an issue that we need to definitely be addressing.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. I did want to talk a little bit about our street improvements generally, because it is very confusing. Who does what? So we have kind of our major street changes, and those are generally going to come from engineering, which is weirdly a different department than traffic engineering, and also a different department than transportation. Engineering does kind of the big street reconstructions, because they're also looking at the sewer and the stormwater, and so they're leading those projects. However, traffic engineering is supporting on like kind of some of these design elements, but those are going to be managed out of the engineering. Then we also have smaller safety improvements. We have a program called Safe Streets Madison. It might do a rapid flashing beacon, a pedestrian island, things that are kind of smaller standalone projects. Those are in our budget and we lead on them, but engineering supports us in like the final design, because we don't want to screw up the stormwater, say, for instance. So we're collaborating on all of these, but they're confusing because it feels like Isn't there just a department? And you might think it's called streets, but they do something totally different than that. So it's very confusing for people, but we do try to help people get to the right place. But small spot improvements, traffic signals, street lights that are standalone projects, traffic engineering is going to be taking the lead on those. And major changes to streets where they get completely ripped up, such as Wilson and Doty, engineering is leading that project, but we're kind of playing a collaborative, supportive role with them. Same thing with maintenance. It's kind of confusing and messy for people. Engineering does sidewalk repairs. They do most of the street and path kind of pavement maintenance. They do some snow removal. Traffic engineering is going to do the pavement markings, the signs, signals, the flashing beacon lights, the pedestrian buttons. We're going to maintain those. We actually don't do really the snow removal side. Streets is going to do sweeping, majority of snow removal. They actually do some pavement maintenance. And parks also does some snow removal, some path pavement maintenance as well. So it's a confusing kind of mess of who's doing what. Luckily, we have a report a problem on the city webpage. And if you go there, it's just going to get to the right people. It's going to go to, I don't know, sometimes 12 or 15 people might get the email to make sure that it can get to the right person. And sometimes it freaks people out because they get responses like out of office messages from three people and they assume no one will see it until everyone's back. But there's probably another 10 people who got it and can deal with it. We also, you know, like concerns that come up around obstructions, vision obstructions at driveways or intersections that can be challenging, that can be reported through report a problem, and building inspection is going to do those inspections and take those complaints. The same for snow clearing that's on private property versus like if it's a public situation like a park or something like that. Building inspection gets those snow clearing complaints and would be the one doing the inspection on those as well. We also do some education. We have one person who's tasked with pedestrian and bicycle outreach and education. Primary focus is really on youth education. We have a good, strong partnership with the school district and the Wisconsin Bike Fed, and the Wisconsin Bike Fed has a couple staff people as well for that. We do some driver education every year, not nearly as much as we would like to do, but we do some yielding to pedestrian campaigns, trying to get people to better understand the law. Yeah, Melissa.
I'll let you finish this page and then I'll ask my question.
Okay, perfect. I'll come back. We do some adult bike safety, particularly around getting lights at night, both to students and, you know, we have some things that we do with the various, I don't know, like we've worked with the Beacon and some groups like that as well. We've done some things in a few, like with libraries and things like that, to try to just target people as well. Not just who don't have them, but who would have more of a challenge affording lights. So we do that every year around the time change. We do a little bit on shared use path etiquette. I know people would like us to do more, but with just one person, focusing on this is a little bit of a challenge, but we do some pop-up signage. We have some permanent signage, flyering at events. We give out bells just to try to raise some awareness. And then our Vision Zero staff team, we kind of have a focus that's coming up on just trying to get people to better understand why they should drive slower. We're implementing something called 20 is Plenty, where we will have a 20 mile per hour speed limit on all of our sort of like residential streets that is coming. And we'll be doing a big campaign to help people understand why and to build support for that. And every year we also do some work in support of White Cane Safety Day to try to just get people to better understand the rules around that and to be more mindful and on the lookout for people who maybe have a service dog or a white cane and really just help the Council for the Blind with that project. And then this year we're doing a big push on an event called A Day Without Driving, which maybe some of you have heard of. It's in the last couple of years become more of a national program to get people to better understand what
life is like and the challenges if you are unable to drive for any reason. It really, in the Pacific Northwest, was a big project for the Disability Rights Commission and advocates there. And we have a good coalition working on that. So if you're interested in more information on that, you can reach out and I can put you in touch with the staff who are have been working on that. It is September 30th through October 6th. It's a week, so that must be the 6th. And I think it's a really good event. I participated last year. I did a day without driving or a week without driving or biking because not driving for me is actually not that hard. So I figured I better not bike and then my life would be more challenging. And, you know, it definitely was kind of eye-opening, the challenges of, you know, relying more on the bus and meetings that get done, you know, always 5 minutes later than you need to catch the bus that you want. And what do you do with that? So I think it's a really good day. And I think we're going to have some people jumping on supporting that and getting involved. So let me know if you're interested. And I'll go back to Melissa now.
So mine was more like of a comment, and it's this, you know, this concept that we all use the road. And so it would be awesome to do like some kind of campaign with, you know, parking was just on here. And so the first thing I wanted to say, I meant to say this first, was thank you for coming on here and presenting this to us and getting us involved and taking us in. I really appreciate that. But yeah, a bigger campaign, a general public, like we all use the road and this is, you know, intended to keep us all safe. I think that would be a really cool thing. I don't know how we do that in the future.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great suggestion. It looks like Joe, you have your hand.
I think Lynn was first, so I'll let her go first.
All right, yeah, I guess Lynn put hers down because I was like, I thought there was someone else.
I just want to be myself and say thank you. I love the idea of the day without driving, and I am really, really glad to hear the last few couple pieces of your report. So thank you, Renee.
Yeah, no, thanks, Lynn. Yeah, Joe.
Yeah, piggybacking, these presentations are great and really appreciate the information. A quick little thought or question, you know, in tandem to the education would be, you know, sometimes like I've gotten my wheelchair stuck on snowy days, you know, like in curb cuts or that. And though, you know, like, you know, understandably the shoveling can be difficult to address. I'm just curious, like I solved the problem of getting stuck because it usually was in like dangerous cold or that by calling the police, you know, but I'm just wondering going forward, even kind of in like thought with, you know, some of the care style programs, if, you know, collectively as the city, we can evaluate if there are additional resources and networks that, you know, like folks could call in if they do have, you know, like a traffic, let's call it a emerge. Well, it's kind of an emergency, but not.
Yeah.
Because I think just in tandem to that, you know, where folks do need help, even a good one is one summer, my chair just stopped working middle of the intersection by the public library, you know, and traffic was driving around me. And it's like, oh, that was terrifying.
Yeah, no, I mean, I can't even imagine. No, I think that's a good suggestion, right? Like, is there something else besides having to be like, oh, I need the police to come out here? Is there some other sort of solution for these kind of situations? Because yeah, I mean, in the winter, I can only imagine that that's a real limiter because curb cuts, even if you have a good sidewalk, someone might not have gotten back to the curb cut after a plow goes through. And so then it's like, you can't complete a trip without the full connection. So I think that's a good suggestion and something to really think about.
Yeah, even elsewhere, you know, we've been discussing like even on the home healthcare initiative of building neighborhood networks, you know, of like where, you know, somebody can just like post, you know, a distress call or that, you know, and if, you know, it would take a while for emergency teams to get there and it's not really like needing the police or fire, you know, that maybe a neighbor or a local, you know, can just come and give a hand.
Yeah, for sure. I like where you're going with that. So I think it's definitely something I'd like to think about and connect with you about more. I think there's some opportunities to think about these kinds of, right, like solutions that are a little out of the box and different, but could be really impactful.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah. All right. Just a little bit about kind of typical pedestrian improvements. Obviously, adding sidewalks or walkways is something that we're trying to do each year, is fill those gaps. You know, I think hopefully it makes sense that that would be a crash reduction factor. I did have someone ask me about that at a meeting. There is an actual study that has been done at the federal level. Just high visibility crosswalks, like making those more visible, like with more of the stripes instead of just the two bars that are on lower volume streets, has been shown to just bring more attention to a driver that they should be paying attention for people crossing. Intersection lighting is huge. That has a really big impact and is something that we're trying to really take a look at with our projects as well, as to how to make those crosswalks really so that a person, you can see them as soon as they're like looking to cross. Just the pedestrian refuge island, where there's enough room for someone to have a full location they can stop in, bumping out the intersections to try to make the crossing as short as possible so that people aren't out in the motor vehicle lanes any longer than necessary. And something that we have really started to build into more of our projects, there's not a ton of them yet, but we're slowly adding them in places, is just having a raised crosswalk where it's level instead of dipping down and going back up, where instead the motor vehicle driver is going to go up and over it instead of the pedestrian or the person with the mobility device going down and back up twice. We also know that they can be fairly jarring. So we're trying to build these better crossings. Yeah, Joe.
I just have to share, I love that raised crosswalk idea, because I used to live over by, you know, like Blair Street, and I would go up Mifflin because I work at the city county building, and would have people just backing out of their driveways. And I understand this can't be done at residence, but I saw it enough even on East Wash, you know, that, yeah, just that little reminder for drivers, you know, that because I even saw a jogger pushing a stroller with his infant in it, you know, and nearly get hit by somebody just speeding out of their driveway, you know. And I think that, yeah, just even those little, like on the highway, you know, bumps, you know, that make that noise that remind you that, oh, you might want to be cautious, you know, coming out of this.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the raised crosswalk, I mean, we don't have a ton yet, but I mean, I do see that it changes the way people approach the crosswalk when it is them who is going, you know, having that change in service instead of the person who's crossing. So I'm excited to see that these are going in a lot more of our projects. Also, and we're going to talk about this in a little bit when Jerry takes over, but, you know, just improving our signals, letting pedestrians go a little bit first, having more accessible signals, more of the flashing beacons to help, I mean, just raise awareness down the road that someone, yes, someone is crossing. You need to be slowing down and preparing to stop for them. There's a reason, especially on, you know, 4-lane roads, why one lane has stopped. So definitely doing more of those. And now, finally, you're done with me. I'm going to hand it over to Jerry Shippa in our office.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jerry Shippa, traffic engineer with the City of Madison. And Renee, if I tell you next, can you hit the
next one? Will do.
Perfect. So, I'm filling in for David, who's off this week. I'll go over these questions that we received first, and then there's a few slides that kind of talk about some other things related to Vision Zero and everything. Just going down the list, how do we determine how long the signal should be for someone to cross the street? I'm assuming this means like the walk and the flashing don't walk. And this timing is based on the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices, the MUTCD. It's kind of a big federal document that recommends or requires signs and control devices out in the roads to be consistent. So when you go to a different state, everything's the same. Their kind of starting point is what we follow, and their starting point for the duration of the walk, which the walk is the time we use to get people into the intersection, that 7 seconds. we can increase this or decrease this based on different factors that might come into effect at the intersection. And then the flashing don't walk, which is the red hand that flashes and may have a countdown timer. We're trying to replace any flash pet signal that doesn't have a countdown timer with those that do. That time is, again, we start out at 3.5 feet per second. Many years ago, it was 4 feet per second, but a few editions of the MUTCD ago, they lower that to 3.5 feet per second. But then it also gives us kind of the flexibility to say, but if there's some nearby land uses that might make sense to go a little bit slower, maybe you're by an assisted care facility or by a hospital or maybe a school, it kind of gives us the flexibility to take that into account. And so that's measured by basically, if you think about it, as you step off the curb, if that flashing don't walk comes on, that is typically either going to be timed long enough to get you across the whole intersection or to the next refuge area, which will have a detectable warning field and a PED signal. So that those are kind of the two main intervals and kind of where they are, what they're based off of. There's a lot of contextual reasons why we might change them, but we do try to stay consistent. The next one is, why are some signals automatic? You don't have to push a button, and others are not. And this is largely based on the demand at that intersection. So where we have intersections which are typically more busy, or even the actual intersection geometry plays a big role in this. Generally speaking, the bigger the intersection, the harder it is to have all these phases come up every single cycle and still be efficient and safe. Whereas the smaller the intersection, it's a lot easier just because we have to go back to that 7 second walk, 3.5 feet per second. If we have a long crossing, that takes a long time. And if we have maybe side streets with low traffic volume and a long PED crossing, and we don't have a lot of pedestrians actually crossing there, we start bringing up phases when there's nobody there, which can really impact signal operations. And actually delay for the pedestrians, which I'll kind of cover in a little bit. But why some locations are recalled is generally because there's more volume, more pedestrian volume there, more activity. The intersections are maybe a little smaller. It's kind of easier to recall all these phases. And in kind of our more suburban intersections or lower activity intersections, they aren't typically recalled. So if you can picture East Washington, working your way out from the Capitol out all the way to the interstate, most signals by the Capitol and all the way out to like Ingersoll, most of those are going to be fixed time recalled. But then the further you get out, you have a little bit less activity, and they are not recalled. And that's something that's always changing, which kind of leads into the next few questions or the next question. As the city changes, these are always revisited. During COVID, we put in a lot of PED recalls into signals. And as we kind of transitioned away from that, we have not just been blanket removing all those. We've been trying to keep as many of those in place as we could. And any of those that we do remove, we are trying to match that with other timing strategies to keep the pedestrian delay either at the same level or actually make it better. So we don't really have any concrete plans to add more recalls, but it's more of a based on what's changing in that area. So as we get more density, as we get more activity, that's definitely going to push us more towards that decision. Are there plans to make, so question number four, are there efforts or plans to make the signals audible? That's an easy answer, and that is yes. We are expecting the USDOT to accept the ProWeg recommendations of anytime we use a pedestrian signal, that it must come equipped with an accessible pedestrian signal. Those are the buttons that say, you know, wait to cross the street, or the walk sign is on. So kind of everyone's kind of reading the tea leaves and going, yeah, the USDOT is going to approve of this sometime in the future, maybe this year, maybe next year. So we just decided, as of 2024, any signal that we are installing new or that we're making significant changes to, we're just going to update them to include the APS buttons. So the answer to that is yes. The next question is, how will crosswalk signals be affected by BRT? Metro reported that BRT will have preference at traffic signals. Will this shorten the time people have to cross the street if a bus is approaching? The short answer to that is no, that won't impact PED signals. How that's going to work is the bus has what's called an AVL system. Think of it as like a GPS device, and they Metro uses that for their bus applications, and their tracking gives you what route it is, where it is it on schedule, and all that kind of information. What we're doing is we're just taking that information and pairing it with our centralized traffic control system, and it's going to use that information to ask the signal to extend to green or shorten the side street phase, if possible, to bring up the green earlier. Now, we can and we are setting parameters in there that we will not omit or shorten any pedestrian phases, but vehicle phases are fine to lengthen or shorten. And that's a little bit different from railroad preemption or emergency vehicle preemption, which are, they're less of an ask, where the bus asks for a little bit extra green time. Those other vehicles demand the signal that I'm an important vehicle, I'm coming, and legally those have some more, we'll call it flexibility in truncating some phases, but we typically also avoid it in those cases as well. Can crosswalks be automated with longer time to cross, or can alternatives be implemented, such as sensors? A few years ago, when we had our East Washington Adaptive Project, we had a video detection system at all these signals. We tested, it's called passive detection. So we draw in a detection zone at the ramps, and we try to pick up where people are waiting to cross to call the walk. And we did find that to be pretty unreliable. We had a lot of false calls and a lot of dropped calls or missed calls. And so we had to disconnect that. That doesn't mean we're necessarily opposed to any kind of technology to do this. We just found that that particular kind was not very reliable. What we are doing with BRT and with other metro routes is using sensors in the road in bus lanes to affect the signal. So right now, what we have at Atwood and Walter, we have a bus pullout where the bus drivers will make a time stop, or, you know, pull over and let people on and off. We have a detector in that pullout that kind of serves two different functions. It'll call so once the bus pulls over that detector, it starts a countdown, and I think it's like 16 seconds after that bus pulls on that detector, basically the signal pushes the PED button. So someone getting off the bus won't have to push that button to cross. And if everything kind of works out, they'll get off the bus and be able to cross the street really without much delay at all. And what that also does is creates a gap so the driver can get back into that single outbound lane without having to worry about merging in. So it kind of helps speed up the bus, and it kind of helps reduce delay for pedestrians, kind of a quality of life improvement for that user. And we're using similar operations on our BRT route, where we have buses running in dedicated bus lanes. We have loop detectors there, and well, if we know that bus is sitting at the stop, there's probably somebody getting off the stop, we'll call the PED phase for the next cycle, so that, you know, if you're getting off the bus and the bus pulls away and the signal changes, you don't have that feeling of, well, I couldn't get to the button in time, so I don't have the walk. The goal is to have it so that walk is brought up automatically. So those are kind of my answers to those questions. And then I had a few other thoughts of some things that we're doing in the city to help improve safety and mobility. So yeah, Renee had mentioned leading pedestrian intervals. So if you can see it, the picture on the right kind of circles a few traffic signals. And what we're showing is what this gives the pedestrian a bit of a head start into the crosswalk. It's usually about 3 to 7 seconds. So they can get into the crosswalk, be more visible while the drivers see a red signal. This is typically either paired with an APS device, so giving the user an audible tone. In cases where it's not, because we don't have many of those, I mean, we have, I think it's about a third of our signals are equipped with them, but there's still a lot of signals without them. And we don't want to miss out on kind of this good operation. What we do then is also increase the walk so that if somebody's going off the audible cue of traffic, they don't get their walk shortened, if that makes sense. Like they will still have a longer walk to enter the crosswalk. But preferably they would be paired with the APS device. The other picture shows what I think is an equally important, if not more important, operation on some of our higher speed streets is what I call a PUFIA. That comes from the Minnesota DOT, but that's ped omit opposing flashing yellow arrow. Basically, all that is if you push the button or if that walk is on, we don't allow left-turning drivers to make a permissive left because we know someone's going to be in that crosswalk or that crosswalk is active. You know, why would we let somebody, in this case at Commercial and Packers, try to shoot across three lanes of traffic and maybe not even see that someone's in that crosswalk? So this started a few years ago when we...
Jerry, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. I just want to be mindful of the time. Our sure. meeting can hard stop at 6:30. We have a couple other items.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Renee, do you want to go to the next slide? I can probably skip through these. I kind of talked about this. You can skip that one. Go to the next one. So the big thing I wanted to bring up here too was that, yes, we are moving towards using more APS buttons. At any new intersection to give users more feedback, as well as exploring bike confirmation buttons that are kind of similar. They don't have the audible tone, but they'll let people know that, you know, you push the button or you've ridden over the detector, you've been, you know, your call is placed, then gives you that audible message for crossing. So yeah, that's all I had.
All right, I'll just be really quick. You can look at this in the materials, but we do have some opportunities and we'll be reaching out more to your committee to as we update our pedestrian plan, which is long overdue. If you have ideas for suggestions for improvements, our Safe Streets Madison, you can go online. We have a variety of different reconstruction and resurfacing projects. They all go to the Transportation Commission, which is every other Wednesday generally at 5 p.m. And our contact information is on here in case you want to reach out with follow-up questions. So thank you.
Thank you so much for coming.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Okie dokie. We will move on to discussion items now. Line item 81696, disability access and equity plan.
Chair, I want to ask if you want to entertain a motion to maybe table our discussion items because they.
Yes, I'm absolutely.
Can report.
You know me, I'm a workaholic and I just power. Thank you for slowing me down. I would like
I'll to. I'll say a motion to table our discussion items for another meeting.
Yeah, thank you. And is there at all? And let me look at everybody.
Casey.
Okay, all right. All in favor? None opposed? Thank you all so much for your time and your talent. Have a good night, y'all. Peace. Y'all know how to reach me. Holla.
Oh, you have some reports still.
I thought we was leaving. I'm sorry. See, I was like, we're done?
We have to have a motion to leave.
I think we're going to try to get through reports in the next minute or
okay,
so.
If we can wrap it up. If not, okay. Well, okay. Let's get back on in here then. Okay. Well, look at that. Reports. 62729 report from Common Council. If you have the capacity. See, I want to just tap into it.
Could you go back to a different report and come back to me? I'm getting a pharmacy bill.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Okay. We'll circle back. Line item 15340, report from the Department of Civil Rights.
So one exciting update is the city has decided to revitalize its ADA transition plan. There isn't a regulatory requirement that a municipality sort of revisit that particular type of document, but it's something that we are going to be endeavoring upon. So that will be something that I'll be sharing with you all as that process continues. And then I wanted to just give maybe 30 seconds to my amazing intern, Maggie, to introduce herself and share about some of the projects she's been working on this summer.
Hi, and sorry earlier for saying I was a commissioner. I just got a little thrown off.
Speaking into existence. Okay, go ahead.
My name's Maggie, as Rebecca said. I've been her intern since June. A couple of amazing projects that myself and the other intern, Faith, have been working on. We wrote and presented a proposal for accessible garden bed tables for those who use different mobility devices to be able to use the community gardens throughout Madison. That presentation to Norm Davis, the head of the Civil Rights, at least from what I could tell, went well. So hopefully if everything goes well for Rebecca and the rest of the team, that will be all, you know, approved by the end of the year. And another major project Faith and I have been working on is writing up a low income resource guide for different like food pantries, shelters, healthcare for low income residents within Madison. So they have quick and easy access to these resources. So yeah, I've been pretty excited about these projects and very happy to be a part of them.
This is Melissa. I just had to say woo-hoo!
Thank you.
Okie dokie. All right.
Okay, line, I can go if you're ready for me.
Great. Okay, we're going to, okay. All right. Line and item 6729. Report from, go ahead, boom.
Really, really quick. All of my updates lately have been about the budget. This one is not going to disappoint because it's about the budget. So we had a Common Council meeting on Tuesday, and if you saw the news release or blasts or blogs from your Alder or other city departments, there was a very big push for residents to submit public comments because the council will be considering whether or not to put a question of referendum to increase tax levies on the ballot for November. So public comment period in terms of public speaking in front of the council has closed, but you can still email the Common Council and share your thoughts about whether or not a referendum question should be put on the ballot by emailing at allalders@cityofmadison.com. Or you can also send those comments, thoughts, or encourage others to reach out to me and I will share with colleagues. The next step then is the council is having a special meeting on the 20th that is going to be entirely focused on discussing, debating what we heard from public testimony on Tuesday, and then ultimately making a vote on whether or not the referendum will be put on the ballot on November and what the language behind that will be. And that's pretty well, I guess I will encourage you if you have not. There's been a lot of media coverage about it. Department heads have submitted their agency requests for the operating budget. And so that kind of reveals if, let's say, a referendum does not pass and a 5% reduction from all departments is asked, what department heads at this point are proposing they would reduce or eliminate to meet that 5% reduction quota. So that is available in the city's finance page, which I had directed you all to when we were talking about the budget engagement events. And if you have any questions, because it is, it's pretty layered, but I think the way that the cuts and proposals or how to continue services as they are has been really outlined well by each department. So please let me know if you have any questions or need links to those references.
Thank you. Well,
thank you. Oh, thank you. All right. So line item 4056, report from the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Humanitarian Award Commission. All right. That's about that.
The July meeting was canceled, so no updates on that front.
Okay. Well, look at that. Well, it's that time, my friends. Is there a motion to, we have completed everything that we've had came to do. Is there a motion to adjourn? Is that appropriate?
Adjourn.
Did I read it correctly? Yes. JL, is it a second?
JL said, yeah.
Oh, God, a second. We...
Pardon?
JL said a motion to adjourn and I second it.
Hey, all in favor? None opposed? All right. Now, see the second take. Peace, y'all. Holla. Yeah, I'm not out of reach.
Bye.